New York, this is Democracy Now!
Any single element of this framework would fundamentally be viewed as a fundamental change in America. Taken together, they're truly consequential.
President Biden makes the case for a slimmed-down framework to address the climate crisis and expand the nation's social safety net. But Democrats remain deeply divided as lawmakers work to pass two key bills at the center of his domestic agenda. Then we look at shadow police units inside Border Patrol.
This is an investigative body within the ranks of the U.S. Border Patrol tasked with investigating Border Patrol-related incidents. They cover up evidence. They delete video. They lie on their reports. I have seen these documents, and I can tell you emphatically that the Border Patrol is investigating itself without any oversight.
And finally, what does the late, great author Toni Morrison have to do with the closely watched Virginia's governor's race? We'll get the latest on the race and hear Toni Morrison in her own words.
Who doesn't know of literature banned because it is interrogative, discredited because it is critical, erased because alternate? And how many are outraged by the thought of a self-ravaged tongue?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. President Biden Thursday unveiled a framework for a revised version of his Build Back Better plan, which is aimed at combating the climate crisis while funding an array of social programs. Biden's scale-back plan would see the U.S. spend $1.75 trillion over a decade, with $555 billion for climate-friendly policies like tax credits for electric vehicles, solar panels, wind turbines, and more energy-efficient buildings. Under pressure from conservative Democrats, Senator Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, many progressive goals have been stripped from the original Build Back Better Act, among them 2 years of community college, paid family and medical leave, and a provision allowing Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices. Still, progressive lawmakers like Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders called the package transformational.
The president and many of us in Congress are trying to pass the most consequential piece of legislation in the modern history of this country for working families.
Senators Sinema and Manchin both sidestepped questions Thursday over whether they'll support the revised spending bill. Meanwhile, progressive Democrats defied House Speaker Nancy Pelosi Thursday, refusing to approve an infrastructure bill passed by the Senate. Lawmakers led by progressive caucus chair Pramila Jayapal say they want the infrastructure bill passed in tandem with the revised Build Back Better Act. Top executives from BP, Chevron, ExxonMobil and Shell appeared before the House Oversight Committee Thursday. During 6 hours of testimony, they repeatedly refused to pledge to stop lobbying against congressional efforts to combat the climate emergency. New York Democrat Carolyn Maloney gaveled in the hearing.
This is a historic hearing. For the first time, top fossil fuel executives are testifying together before Congress under oath about the industry's role in causing climate change and their efforts to cover it up. For far too long, Big Oil has escaped accountability for its central role in bringing our planet to the brink of a climate catastrophe. That ends today.
Throughout Thursday's hearing, Republicans repeatedly apologized to the oil company executives, while progressives grilled them over their campaign to prevent action on the climate crisis. This is New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
One thing that often gets lost in these conversations is that some of us have to actually live the future that you all are setting on fire for us. By 2028, crop yields are already projected to begin to fail with famine beginning to hit the world's most vulnerable populations.
Committee Chair Carolyn Maloney said she plans to issue subpoenas to force oil executives to turn over documents detailing what their own scientists were saying internally about climate change, as well as big oil's efforts to misinform the public. A new United Nations report warns at least 10 forest-designated World Heritage sites have become net emitters of greenhouse gases, no longer absorbing more carbon than they emit. The disturbing trend is driven by drought, wildfires, and deforestation, including in California's Yosemite National Park. China submitted its climate action goals ahead of the COP26 United Nations Climate Summit, which opens next week in Glasgow. China says it plans to see its carbon dioxide emissions peak by 2030, achieving carbon neutrality by 2060. The pledge contains no significant new environmental goals. Climate activists say it's far short of what's needed from China to help prevent the worst effects of the climate crisis. In Scotland, protesters gathered Thursday near the site of next week's COP26 summit, demanding countries take real action to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
We have to try and remind world leaders what's happening with the crisis. The world is literally on fire, and it's only going to get worse.
From wildfires in the U.S. to flooding across the world, we are in a full-blown climate crisis. World leaders know this. They've seen what's happening. Now's the time for them to come together here in Glasgow and hammer out a deal to avert the worst of the climate catastrophe.
Tune in for the next 2 weeks for Democracy Now!'s coverage of the UN Climate Summit. President Biden met with Pope Francis at the Vatican today, ahead of the G20 summit in Rome. The Pope has called for global vaccine equity and has urged world leaders to do more to tackle the climate emergency. In 2015, he penned the encyclical on climate change and inequality. On Thursday, before his departure for Europe, activists held a rally in Washington, D.C. to demand President Biden keep his promise to make the COVID vaccine available to all countries and to put people over profit. This is human rights advocate Pauline Machina.
We talk about solidarity. We talk about global community. But we are hoarding vaccines. Yes. 500 million vaccines were promised by President Biden. How many of them have left the United States? We hear people throwing out vaccines. How many vaccines are being destroyed instead of shared around the world? It is time to end vaccines apartheid.
The rally was followed by an all-night vigil in front of the home of White House coronavirus response coordinator Jeffrey Zients. More protests are expected in Italy over the weekend as the G20 gets underway. In Sudan, at least one protester was killed Thursday on the fourth consecutive day of clashes between soldiers and demonstrators in Khartoum who opposed Monday's military coup. A Guantanamo Bay prisoner and survivor of U.S. government torture gave a detailed account of his brutal captivity to a military jury Thursday. 41-year-old Majid Khan is the first former prisoner of CIA black sites to describe so-called enhanced interrogation techniques in an open court. For more than 2 hours, Khan described force feedings, waterboarding, and other physical and sexual abuse he endured, including extended periods of nudity, where he was detained in the CIA's network of overseas prisons from 2003 to 2006. Khan was captured in Pakistan in 2003 and pleaded guilty to being an al-Qaeda courier in 2012. He's being sentenced today. In immigration news, the Wall Street Journal reports the Biden administration's in negotiations to pay millions of dollars in reparations to families who were separated at the U.S.-Mexico border under Trump's zero-tolerance policy. The payments would amount to $450,000 per person. This comes as part of efforts to settle several lawsuits filed on behalf of hundreds of separated parents and children who say they're still suffering from emotional distress, trauma, and psychological harm. In related news, a federal jury in Tacoma, Washington, has determined the private prison corporation GEO Group must pay minimum wage rather than a dollar a day to immigrants detained at its Northwest Detention Center who are ordered to perform tasks like cooking and cleaning. Facebook has changed its name to Meta. as it attempts to major rebrand amidst mounting scandals. The company said the name better reflects its expansion into virtual and augmented reality. It'll keep the name Facebook for its popular social media app. The group Real Facebook Oversight Board said, quote, changing their name doesn't change reality. Facebook is destroying our democracy and is the world's leading peddler of disinformation and hate. Their meaningless name change should not distract from the investigation, regulation, and real independent oversight needed to hold Facebook accountable, they said. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has been charged with forcible touching, a misdemeanor crime, for allegedly groping his aide inside the executive mansion last year. The disgraced governor, who was forced to resign in August amidst a flurry of sexual misconduct claims, will have to appear in court November 17th for arraignment. The Justice Department has agreed to pay an $88 million settlement to survivors and families of victims killed by the white supremacist in the 2015 mass shooting at the historically black Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. This comes after 14 plaintiffs filed a civil case against the FBI, accusing the agency of neglect for failing to prohibit the sale of the firearm convicted murderer Dylan Roof used in the massacre. Meanwhile, in Virginia, jurors heard opening statements Thursday in the federal civil trial that charges the organizers of the deadly white supremacist Unite the Right rally in 2017 with an unlawful conspiracy to commit violent acts. In his opening statement, the jailed neo-Nazi Christopher Cantwell, one of 24 organizers of the deadly rally, made references to Mein Kampf and said the N-word and blasted anti-fascist advocates all within a matter of minutes. A warning to our audience, this story contains graphic descriptions of an execution. In Oklahoma, prison officials Thursday strapped condemned 60-year-old prisoner John Marion Grant to a gurney and injected him with a lethal cocktail of three drugs, midazolam, vecuronium bromide, and potassium chloride. AP reporter Sean Murphy witnessed the execution.
As the drugs began to flow, the first drug, the midazolam, he exhaled deeply. He began convulsing about two dozen times, full body convulsions, and then began to vomit, which covered his face and began to run down his neck and the side of his face. Continued to breathe for several minutes before two members of the medical team or the execution team came in and wiped his face. At that point, he was still breathing.
After more involuntary convulsions and more vomiting, Grant was finally pronounced dead at 4:20 p.m. local time. It was Oklahoma's first execution in 6 years. A string of botched attempts forced Oklahoma to halt such killings. It came after the Supreme Court ruled 5-3 Thursday to lift a lower court stay. Lawyers for Grant and another prisoner, Julius Jones, had argued Oklahoma's three-drug cocktail of lethal injection drugs would subject them to excruciating pain. They also said an Oklahoma law forcing them to choose their method of execution violated their religious rights and amounted to suicide. Oklahoma plans six more executions in the next several months. And Lisa Brodiaga, the pioneering lawyer and fierce defender of immigrant rights, has died at the age of 80. Brodiaga founded the first pro bono law office to represent refugees in U.S. immigration prisons. In the 1980s, she spearheaded efforts to defend thousands of Central American asylum seekers in the U.S., many of whom fled repressive and brutal U.S.-backed regimes. In recent years, she fought for legal protection of children being held in cages near the border under the Trump administration. In 1986, Brodiaga founded the Refugio del Rio Grande in South Texas, a safe community for refugees from around the world. She passed away at her home on Thursday. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Democrats remain deeply divided over two key bills at the center of President Biden's domestic agenda, the now $1.85 trillion Build Back Better plan and a smaller, more than $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was forced to postpone a vote Thursday on the infrastructure bill after progressive Democrats demanded again that both bills be considered in tandem. In a statement, Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said, quote, "There's too much at stake for working families in our communities to settle for something that can be later misunderstood, amended, or abandoned altogether," she said. Earlier in the day, President Biden addressed the nation, outlining what he described as an historic economic framework.
It's a framework that will create millions of jobs, grow the economy, invest in our nation and our people, turn the climate crisis into an opportunity, and put us on a path not only to compete, but to win the economic competition for the 21st century against China and every other major country in the world. It's fiscally responsible. It's fully paid for. This framework includes historic investments in our nation and in our people. Any single element of this framework would be viewed as a fundamental change in America. Taken together, they're truly consequential.
Even though Biden's framework is almost half the size of the original $3.5 trillion proposal, two key conservative Democratic senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, have refused so far to commit to supporting it. The new framework strips out several key provisions, including paid family leave, free community college, expanded Medicare coverage for dental and vision, as well as prescription drug reform, which would save billions of dollars. Key elements still in the framework include provisions to provide universal pre-K, expanded child tax credit for another year, affordable child care, affordable housing, free school meals, and expanded Medicare for hearing services. The framework also includes over $500 billion for climate initiatives, which Biden highlighted Thursday.
This framework also makes the most significant investment to deal with the climate crisis ever happened, beyond any other advanced nation in the world. Over a billion metric tons of emission reductions, at least 10 times bigger on climate than any bill that has ever passed before, and enough to position us for a 50 to 52% emission reductions by the year 2020.
Director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School, also a Henry Cohen Professor of Economics and Urban Policy. He was a surrogate and economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, also one of Sanders' appointee members to the Biden-Sanders Joint Task Force. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Hamilton. Can you lay out this moment, what we are looking at? Again, a deadline was set by the Democrats to vote on the bipartisan bill yesterday, but progressive Congress members balked, saying they always said both bills would have to be voted on in tandem, the infrastructure bill and the Build Back Better plan, which is Biden's agenda. Talk about what's in and what's out, and give us the economic story behind it.
Well, we are at a pivotal moment, and I'm glad that the Progressive Caucus is holding a line in ensuring that certain things get passed in this legislation. That the word compromise, we've seen it in the past where far too often we've compromised too much. In fact, I prefer not even to use that word. I guess strategy is what we have to do in this moment. But, start with the good news. The good news is that if we put this bill in context of the last 40 years, this is a pivotal change from the ways in which government has engaged in ensuring that people have adequacy in which they engage. And we could talk about specifics. I mean, addressing our climate, you know, we could talk about other specifics. We could talk about what else? What else is in the bill? Child tax credit. You know, it should be known that this is the 25th year anniversary of welfare reform. And if you juxtapose welfare reform, where we became punitive in how we dealt with poverty, with all these conditions in order to receive basic needs with a child tax credit, that is a narrative change, and that is a change in which government engages with people, ensuring that they have resources so that they can have agency in their lives, make choices that's important for them.
I mean, what's amazing is how overwhelmingly popular, even among Republicans around the country, some of the programs are that were cut out. For example, the expansion of Medicare for hearing services, very popular, but also for dental and for vision, extremely popular, but that's cut out.
Yeah, and you're right. And this is the economics of this can't be separable from the politics of this. When you have two, as you characterize accurately, conservative Democratic senators being able to stop this from going forward, that's a problem. And what's more, if we think about the other side of the aisle, I mean, what is clear is that even with something like a fascist coup attempt of January 6th, when they're obstructing that investigation, they clearly aren't partners in trying to generate what's good for the American people. So the politics are problematic, even when the masses of Americans recognize the benefits of something as simple as Medicare providing hearing coverage for seniors.
So what about the latest on Medicare drug price negotiations? The CBO estimates over $450 billion in 10 years savings from the Medicare drug price negotiation provision. But this Medicare prescription drug reform is out.
Yeah. And you know, again, this is common sense, obvious policy in that it's cost savings for the American government, and it brings something positive to the American people. But yet the stench of politics are interfering with our ability to get to move it forth. There's no question the lobbying that's going on right now to prevent that provision from the drug companies.
Paid family leave. It was Senator Manchin, the largest recipient of oil, gas, coal money in Congress, who says no to a person having paid family leave. That means a person gives birth on a Sunday night, and if they don't have money, they're expected to work on Monday morning if they can't afford unpaid leave. Originally, the proposal was 12 weeks paid. That was reduced to 4 weeks. Now, none.
Yeah, it's inhumane. It's inhumane in favor of corporations. But, you know, Amy, we could also talk about again, we're talking about if we put this in context of narrative change, and I do want to give your audience some of the positive. We talk about the taxes that are being used to pay for this bill, which is another framing I don't like either, because America certainly has enough resources to not only do paid sick leave, but really begin to at least redress our climate crises. But what I like about these taxes, the taxes tilted towards the wealthy Americans, is that it's redressing plutocracy. The problem is not that we need those resources to pay for the things we need. It is that class of individual has too much resources so that they can do things like obstruct our ability to provide hearing through Medicare, to address our environmental crisis, and provide all Americans with the dignity of paid family leave as well as paid medical leave. We need to get those that immoral money out of politics. The fact that you have the hands of special interests being able to co-opt our political process in ways to stop our economic agenda, that's also a problem. And, you know, at least implicitly, this bill has some measures to begin to redress that.
Right now, women on social media are sharing images of their babies at 4 weeks as a way to emphasize how hard it is to go back to work at that point. That was when they had reduced it from 12 to 4. Now it's at nothing.
Yeah, it's shameful. You know, there really is nothing more to say than it's shameful. And again, if we put this in international comparisons, Every other country with income levels that are similar to that of America has paid family leave. So why aren't we being able to do it? To me, the answer is clear. The special interest being able to lobby our government corrupts it. It corrupts our government and keeps us from being able to do what is obviously good policy.
So let's talk about the climate, what's included and what isn't. And we're talking about two different bills. Now, there are a number of progressives who are saying even with this pared-down Build Back Better Act, they are willing to support it if it is voted on in tandem with the so-called bipartisan bill. But Manchin and Sinema have not even agreed that if the bipartisan bill is voted on, that they will vote for the Build Back Better Act.
Which is why I like the Progressive Caucus also coming back with a strategic notion of we're not just going to roll over. We want some assurance, even if we're going to get this compromise bill, this at least beginning first step to start moving the government to redress our climate crisis. I mean, another aspect of it, Amy, is that the bill is largely incentives, is largely directed at trying to incentivize corporations, utilities in particular, to behave better with regards to clean energy and better technologies to redress our climate issues.
Well, let's talk about that. The Build Back Better Act having something like $555 billion, $500 billion for climate policies like tax credits, encouraging electric vehicles, solar panels, wind turbines, and more energy efficient buildings.
Yeah, I mean, the incentives are useful, but we obviously need to do more. We need to have public options. We need a government that's engaged in and making sure our economy is green and directly providing those energy sources. Not only will that ensure that it gets done, but who will own those assets? The public will own those assets. So in addition to these incentives, we have a long way to go. We know that $550 billion is clearly not enough. But I still want to emphasize the positive, which is if we compare this in a historical context, this really is transformative. And the other element is we got here because people have agitated and got us to this point. So at the end of the day, the power still rests with people. And I would consider this as an opening, but we still have a long way to go.
Well, Derek Hamilton, I want to thank you so much for being with us, founding director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School, also the Henry Cohen Professor of Economics and Urban Policy there. And for folks, tune in for our coverage for the next 2 weeks of the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow. We'll be bringing you news from inside the summit, the protest outside, and hear from people all around the world who couldn't go to Glasgow, but who are fighting on the ground to deal with the climate emergency. Next up, we look at new revelations about shadow police units inside Border Patrol. And then, what does the late, great Nobel Prize-winning novelist Toni Morrison have to do with the current Virginia governor's race? We'll talk about that. Stay with us.
De tu veneno y tu reproche, y aunque sé que te olvidaste, todavía falta poco. Cada día poco a poco, oh, todavía falta poco. Cada día poco a poco. Yeah, yeah.
by Vicente Garcia. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Human rights advocates are calling on Congress to investigate how shadow police units along the U.S.-Mexico border have helped cover up beatings and murders by Border Patrol agents for more than three decades. New details came to light when attorneys investigating the 2010 Border Patrol killing of Mexican father Anastasio Hernandez Rojas found a secretive special investigative unit tampered with and even destroyed evidence in the case to shield the agents involved. Rojas was beaten and shocked to death by the agents after he tried to cross the border to return to San Diego, California, where he'd lived for 25 years to be with his five children. Rojas lay on the ground, handcuffed at the San Ysidro port of entry, as agents beat him with batons and shocked him with a stun gun. He died at the hospital several days later. The San Diego coroner's office classified Anastasio's death as a homicide, concluding he suffered a heart attack as well as, quote, bruising to his chest, stomach, hips, knees, back, lips, head, and eyelids, five broken ribs, and a damaged spine. After the assault, Border Patrol never notified San Diego police of the incident. Instead, it's now clear that it had its own critical incident team, that's CIT, control witness lists, remove language in a report that described Rojas as being compliant during his arrest. Agents were also at the hospital directing doctors who treated Rojas before he died. Democracy Now! Spoke with Anastasio Hernandez's Rojas's brother, Bernardo, in 2016.
Anastasio was murdered.
Fue torturado.
He was tortured.
El 28 de mayo de,
on the 28th of May, 2010.
Han pasado cinco años y no hemos
Five years have justicia. Elapsed, and we've not found justice.
Durante estos cinco años hemos estado
During these five years, we have been fighting
por encontrar justicia y no
for
han hecho
justice,
caso.
And they have no not paid attention to us.
Porque durante estos cinco años hemos for conocido during también these five years, que
we have also met other people who have gone through the same
y
thing.
Siguen pasando muchas cosas en la frontera
and many
igual.
Things, many very similar things continue to happen
que
at the border.
Que hagan alto a
we want this to stop. We want them to stop these
y
injustices.
Una respuesta del gobierno
and we want a response from the government as to what's happening with
no
my brother's case, and why have they not responded with good news?
With the new details in this case and others now brought to light, on Thursday, the Southern Border Communities Coalition sent a letter to Congress to, quote, sound the alarm on the dangerous overreach of the illegal operation of U.S. Border Patrol's unlawful critical incident teams. For more, we're joined in Los Angeles by award-winning investigative journalist John Carlos Frey, who's reported extensively on human rights abuses at the U.S.-Mexico border, author of Sand and Blood, America's Stealth War on the Mexico Border. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about the case we just went through in light of the new information that you're uncovering about these shadow police units within U.S. Border Patrol?
Yes, of course. It's good to be with you, Amy. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and it is shocking. Within the actual agency of the U.S. Border Patrol, there is an investigative body called CIT, the Critical Incident Team. They are tasked with investigating incidents that involve Border Patrol, and it can be anything from a car accident to, in this case, an individual who's killed at the hands of the U.S. Border Patrol. In this particular case of Anastasio Hernandez Rojas, Border Patrol agents deleted video. They collected evidence at the scene. They were present in the hospital when Anastasio was being treated. They were present at the autopsy. They fudged reports. They deleted reports. They coached their own agents on what kind of testimony they were to give. They were present at every one of the depositions. They made sure that they were the victims in this case. And when I say that, what I mean is that Border Patrol agents, CIT team agents, make sure that Border Patrol agents are looked at as the victims in any sort of an incident, meaning that they are allowed then to use lethal force. If a Border Patrol agent has rocks thrown at them, or in the case of Anastasio, they allege that Anastasio was violent and that he was kicking and punching and he needed to be subdued. If we take a look at the videotape, That's not actually what happened. He's handcuffed. He's prone on the ground. His face is down. Agents are on top of him. But if you read the reports in this case that were prepared by CIT, Anastasio was a violent man and needed to be subdued. So anywhere from the beginning of the investigation to the end of the investigation, CIT team members tampered with evidence. They obstructed justice, and they violated the law, not just because of what they did with the actual evidence in the case, but they don't even have an authority to exist. There is not a police agency, whether it's a municipal police agency or a federal police agency, that gets to investigate itself without any oversight. And that's what the Border Patrol is doing right now.
So talk about what has been uncovered and what exactly the group on the border, the letter that has been sent to Congress.
Yeah, I was actually, you know, it's something that a reporter doesn't usually do, working with non-governmental organizations like the Southern Border Communities Coalition. But I had handed them evidence because they would like to get a congressional hearing off the ground. One of the pieces of evidence that I had uncovered was a PowerPoint presentation that was actually produced by the U.S. Border Patrol about these secret police agencies or investigative bodies within the Border Patrol. And in that PowerPoint prepared by the Border Patrol, it's very specific as to what these CIT team members are supposed to be doing at an incident or where a Border Patrol agent is involved. They are there to mitigate litigation. That is a quote. Border Patrol agents who investigate an incident are there to mitigate litigation. They're not there to collect evidence. They're not there to make sure that they are looking at the facts, but they're there to make sure that Border Patrol agents are not prosecuted. That's one of their primary goals. They're also there, as I said earlier, to make sure that Border Patrol agents look like they were the ones that were accosted or that they themselves are the victims, so that any use of force is warranted. They are there to make sure that Border Patrol get the right spin and make sure that they get their message out properly. This is in the PowerPoint presentation prepared by Border Patrol. Their own critical investigative teams are there to mitigate any sort of liability that makes the Border Patrol look bad or brings any kind of charges against them. So I'm not sure how objective they are out in the field. And as we were talking about in the case of Anastasio, it is rife with corruption.
I want to go to the case of 16-year-old Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez, who was killed in Nogales, Mexico, by U.S. Border Patrol agent Lonnie Swartz, who fired his gun from the U.S. side of the border through the wall. The teenager, who was unarmed, died face down on the sidewalk just a couple of blocks from his home. After nearly 5 years of legal delays, Jose Antonio's mother, Araceli Rodriguez, and his grandmother brought Swartz to trial for second-degree murder in 2017. A Tucson, Arizona jury acquitted him and were deadlocked on manslaughter charges in a second trial in 2018. Swartz was found not guilty of involuntary manslaughter. During the court proceedings, it was revealed a local Border Patrol special investigative unit had collected all the evidence for the FBI. We were with Jose Antonio's mother, Araceli, in Nogales in 2019 in Sonora at the site where her son was murdered.
The Border Patrol agent said he feared for his life. He would have been standing, 30 feet above your son walking here on the sidewalk. Can you respond to the agent saying he feared for his life?
Que son puras mentiras, que en todo momento mintió.
That Lonnie Swartz lied the whole time. He tried to defend something indefensible. There was a video because there's a camera right there. There was a video that was allegedly lost where it showed Lonnie Swartz murdering my son.
Es no creíble lo que él dice, que su vida estaba en peligro.
What he says about his life being in danger is not true. Everyone who comes here and sees the height of this wall realizes that Lonnie Swartz was lying about my son throwing rocks.
No estaba en peligro su vida. Dijeron que él se pudo haber quitado. Nunca comprobaron que José Antonio tiró piedras. Nunca comprobaron.
His own co-workers at the trial said that his life was not in danger, that he could have stepped away. It was never proven that Jose Antonio was throwing rocks.
And there is Antonio's mother, Araceli, in Nogales, Sonora, in 2019, at the site where her son was murdered. She's standing right in front of a picture of her son as we investigated this case at the time. John Carlos Frey, this case, among others, is referenced in the letter to Congress. Can you talk about the information that came out around the CIT units and what they did in covering this up?
It is a very disturbing case and a very disturbing trend here. A 15-year-old boy shot in the back, unarmed, standing in Mexico while the U.S. Border Patrol agent was standing in the United States, found not guilty, basically. Lonnie Schwartz is the only Border Patrol agent prosecuted for misfiring his weapon in the entire history of the U.S. Border Patrol. That's the only person who's been prosecuted. There were a couple of other agents who were prosecuted in Texas during the Bush administration for firing their weapon at a drug dealer. They hit him in the back. But this is the first time in U.S. Border Patrol history that anybody has been prosecuted for the death of an individual. In the past 15 years, over 100 individuals have been killed at the hands of the U.S. Border Patrol at the border, and not one of them has been brought to prosecution. That is what CIT is doing. They are preparing evidence. They are doctoring evidence. They are tampering with evidence. They are deleting evidence. They are making sure that agents themselves look like they are firing their weapons properly, that everything they do is on the up and up, and there's nothing to see here. In the case that we're talking about, there was an unarmed boy who was shot in the back. There were two surveillance video cameras that are anchored right on the top of the border fence. They're pointed right where the incident occurred. That video is missing. We don't know what happened to it because CIT prepared the investigation. The Border Patrol prepared that investigation. So, if we're talking about making sure that they defend themselves against civil liability, well, of course, they're going to delete that video.
John Carlos Frey, we want to thank you for being with us. Award-winning investigative journalist, reported extensively on immigration, author of the book Sand and Blood, America's Stealth War on the Mexico Border. Coming up, what does the late, great Nobel Prize-winning novelist Toni Morrison have to do with the Virginia governor's race? Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to the closely watched Virginia governor's race that pits former Governor Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat, against Republican Glenn Youngkin, the former CEO of the Carlyle Group, one of the world's largest private equity firms. Vice President Kamala Harris will campaign in Norfolk, Virginia, with McAuliffe today. Former President Trump's planning to hold a telerally for Youngkin on Monday. President Biden campaigned with McAuliffe earlier this week and warned Youngkin is an extremist in the vein of former President Trump.
Extremism can come in many forms. It can come in the rage of a mob driven to assault the Capitol. It can come in a smile and a fleece vest.
Youngkin has campaigned in part by vowing to support so-called parents' rights, which has become a catch-all phrase to describe right-wing opposition to vaccine and mask mandates, trans rights for students, and critical race theory. There's even been a firestorm in the race over the teaching of Toni Morrison's acclaimed novel, Beloved, in schools. We're going to look at that in a moment. But first, we're joined by Julia Manchester, the national political reporter for The Hill, who's been covering the Virginia governor's race. Welcome to Democracy Now! Now, talk about the issues in these last few days in this race that's seen as the bellwether for the country about what will happen in the midterm elections next year, Julia.
Well, good morning, Amy. We've seen a number of issues really be centerpieces of both McAuliffe and Youngkin's campaigns in the closing days of this race. As you said, this issue of so-called parents' rights has become a huge issue for Youngkin. Youngkin very much seizing upon these very tensionous and sometimes dangerous school board meetings that we've seen in Loudoun County, Virginia, and across the country, very much saying that parents have a right to be involved in their children's education, and that elected school board officials are essentially political figures trying to influence Virginia students' education. Youngkin very much seizing upon Terry McAuliffe's comments last month, in which he said he did not believe that parents should be involved in a child's education in the school system. Now, Terry McAuliffe very much pushing back against that, saying that, of course, he believes parents should have some say in their children's education, and very much touting the fact that he launched his campaign on education, pledging to spend $2 billion per year on Virginia public school system. So that's one issue we're seeing. We're also seeing this nationwide issue over abortion rights very much leaking into or seeping into this race. You have Terry McAuliffe saying Glenn Youngkin will implement some sort of abortion ban in Virginia, similar to maybe that seen in Texas, where it's abortion is banned after 6 weeks of pregnancy. So, you know, Terry McAuliffe very much warning Democratic voters about that. Youngkin pushing back, saying that unlike the Texas ban, he believes in abortion in the cases of rape and incest. You're also seeing President Biden and his own approval rating impacting this race. You know, as the race between Youngkin and McAuliffe has grown more narrow, you've seen in Virginia President Biden's own approval ratings start to tick down. And I think that's why a lot of Virginia Democrats are closely watching what's happening on Capitol Hill with Biden's agenda, hoping for a victory between now and November 2nd to prove that, you know, if under Democratic leadership on Capitol Hill, they can get that done, they can get the same initiatives done in Virginia. And finally, President Trump himself is an issue. Despite the fact that he is not on the ballot this year in Virginia and he is not the sitting president, Terry McAuliffe has invoked President Trump's name quite a bit in this race, maybe just as much, if not more, than Glenn Youngkin's name in an effort to tie Glenn Youngkin to Donald Trump.
And it's clear, I mean, he hasn't been out on the campaign trail with him, not sure whose choice it is, but this Teller rally that will be held on Monday, among the things that Youngkin is willing to openly embrace, calling for the audit of election machines, of course, continuing that lie that the elections were rigged.
Yes, this is something Youngkin has called for ever since he launched his campaign earlier this year. In fact, in February, his campaign launched an election integrity task force. So he's been very much talking about this, and he talked about this during the Republican convention much more publicly because he was trying to appeal to that deep red, maybe pro-Trump conservative base in Virginia. However, now that he's gotten into the general election against McAuliffe, he has to be careful with how much he embraces Trump and the issue of election integrity publicly, because he's also trying to appeal to these moderate, more suburban voters, maybe in some cases more left-leaning voters or slightly left-leaning voters trying to peel off some votes from Terry McAuliffe. But the issue is President Trump is extremely unpopular in Virginia. He lost Virginia in 2016 and 2020. And part of the reason for that is because the population centers in Virginia, whether that's Northern Virginia outside of Washington, D.C., Richmond, the Norfolk area, Hampton Roads, those all are incredibly blue-leaning parts of Virginia. Those are the population centers. And mathematically, there's more Democratic voters in Virginia than there are Republican voters. So this is all about a turnout game. The problem is there's more Republican enthusiasm at this moment in Virginia than there is Democratic enthusiasm.
As we mentioned, there's been a firestorm in the Virginia race over the teaching of Toni Morrison's acclaimed Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Beloved, in schools. It stems from an ad by the Republican candidate Glenn Youngkin that features a mother who once campaigned to have the book banned from her high school senior son's curriculum. This is a clip of that ad.
As a parent, it's tough to catch everything. So when my son showed me his reading assignment, my heart sunk. It was some of the most explicit material you can imagine. I met with lawmakers. They couldn't believe what I was showing them. Their faces turned bright red with embarrassment.
Well, for more, we're joined by Dana Williams, Dean of the Graduate School of Professor of African American Literature at Howard University. She's also president of the Toni Morrison Society. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dean Williams. This is an amazing teaching moment that you have the late, great Nobel Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Toni Morrison at the center of the Virginia race. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Yeah, I would agree with you completely that it's an amazing moment. I mean, I don't think that there are any instances where there isn't a Morrison novel that applies to a political situation, but I don't know that this is what she imagined. She did have quite a bit to say, actually, about censorship and banning books and work with the PEN America Foundation to actually publish a book called Burn This Book, where she talked a lot about censorship and really had that conversation around the idea of what it means to have good literature, to create open discussions. And unfortunately, part of what we have to face and admit is that all segments of our populations and just aren't interested in the intellectualism that literature does. And there's actually a significant anti-intellectual population. This book, ironically, though, is an incredible metaphor for all of the things that we are trying to think about. Choice, parental choice in particular. And then it also has some resonances, ironically, too, with the abortion issue, since the book itself turns on Setha, the main character's decision to practice infanticide rather than have her child return to slavery. So there's so many different cultural elements that are present in this book that speak tremendously to the moment that we find ourselves in.
I want to go to Toni Morrison in her own words. Her Nobel lecture from December 1993, when she became the first African-American woman to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Who doesn't know of literature banned because it is interrogative, discredited because it is critical, erased because alternate, and how many are outraged by the thought of a self-ravaged tongue? Word work is sublime, she thinks, because it's generative. It makes meaning that secures our difference, our human difference, the way in which we are like no other life.
So that was Toni Morrison in 1993. And now you have this ad. Laura Murphy is not just a Virginia mom. As we said earlier in the ad, as she talked about her son's embarrassment reading the book, they don't actually refer to Beloved, but she is very well known for trying to get it banned in the schools and ultimately it trying to get a bill passed that McAuliffe, I think, vetoed twice. Can you talk more about the significance of Beloved and this whole battle in the schools and what Toni Morrison would say today?
Well, I think a big part of the conversation is around explicit language, if you will. But we have seen so much of the conversation in the last couple of days remind us that explicit language that represents a reality pales in comparison to the reality that the people had to suffer. So I would agree to some degree with those who have described the ad as a dog whistle, a racist dog whistle, as a matter of fact, particularly that element that suggests that the lawmakers turned red in the face. I mean, that in and of itself says that there are no Black lawmakers who were part of that conversation, just sheerly by the force of melanin, unable to turn beet red in the face, if you will. But it also speaks to the real tension that's happening in our public school system in a general sense, from Texas to other places all over the country, where critical race studies or critical race theory, at least the popular culture interpretations of them, is under fire. So how do we think about a book that helps us to think about slavery in a way that humanizes the people who were enslaved and then creates scenarios that make very clear in ways that only fiction can. History can't represent the emotional aspect of it. It can't represent the sheer force of brutality around it. What are the implications of trying to create explicit warnings or ban or have some elements of censorship on those kinds of books that really teach us about a past that we have to face? And Beloved, as this novel that really is about a haunting, the haunting of a child who says, no, you don't get to forget the past completely, that you must confront it. And these are characters who overwhelmingly are trying to move away from that past of enslavement because they have freed themselves. They have dared to try to free themselves in that kind of moment. But Beloved still is saying that confrontation must be there. Otherwise, the haunting continues. And it's what's happening in Virginia. You really couldn't pen a better story to suggest that if you don't face and confront the past, whether it's in its statuary, whether it's in its architecture, whether it's in the stories that we tell, if you don't confront it, it continues to haunt us.
When she talks about her son, she doesn't say he was an AP high school senior, and it's now years later. He's a Republican activist lawyer. But I wanted to quote Charles Blow in an article he wrote, an op-ed piece in The New York Times, saying, Youngkin wants to resurface this coded debate because it helps Republicans convert schools into battlegrounds where they can use the protection of children and parental rights as shields behind which to wage a culture war over race, gender, and states' rights disguised as a defense of the innocent. If you could respond to this, Dean Williams.
I would agree with that. And it only happens to be the case that Charles and I are both alumni of Grambling State University. We are probably trained quite similarly by some of the same people. So we are well aware and very capable of understanding when there is coded language to say that the fight over culture, the fight over states' rights is something that we have to confront from the Civil War. That really is the war that we continue to wage. Reconstruction had some adjustments to make, and it seemed as though in southern states in particular, that there would be some reckoning with the federal versus the state issues. But we know that the conversation that says that the Civil War was fought around states' rights is not as authentic as one that really does grapple with the Civil War as being about enslavement and about the humanity of people and who gets to choose. So much of what we see in the Margaret Garner story, which inspires Beloved, is about an inability for even slaveholders to grapple with the legalese. I mean, they didn't know whether to charge her with murder, because if they charged her with murder, it would mean that that child was to be considered a full human. So they opt not to and decide to focus more on the destruction of property and then to sell her off to Louisiana. So I think books like Beloved really do force us to have real conversations about history and to think about the culture wars and what it means to lose a culture war in the cradle of the Confederacy. It's not lost on any of us that this is an issue that is raising its head in Virginia, in particular, a state.
Julia, finally, as we've just lost Dean Williams, your final comments on how this is playing out in the last few days of this race in Virginia.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we saw that ad that Youngkin put out. I believe it was Monday or two. I think it was Monday. And it, although Beloved wasn't mentioned in the ad and the book wasn't explicitly mentioned, it didn't take long for opposition researchers or journalists to Google Laura Murphy and find a 2013 Washington Post article about her her efforts to ban Beloved. Now, Laura Murphy said in that article she didn't necessarily want to ban it altogether forever from the curriculum. She said that, you know, she wanted parents to at least have a say in what books were assigned or have a say in opting what, you know, whether their children could opt out in reading a book. However,
we have 5 seconds, Julia.
Yeah, yeah. You've really seen McAuliffe's campaign very much seize upon this, especially at a time when you see a lot of big galvanization of black voters in Virginia. It'll be interesting to see how this impacts
Julia it. Manchester, thanks so much for joining us from The Hill. And Dean Dana Williams of Howard University, thank you so much. That does it for our show. A very fond farewell to two special team members, our fellows Julia Thomas and Adriano Contreras. Julia and Adriano joined us before the pandemic swept the globe, demonstrated remarkable talent and resilience through this difficult time. We thank you both for your dedication. Wish you the best as you move forward in your careers. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Ville de Mars et mon turf. Narcotique puissant que ce putain d'argent sur le surf. J'ai tout pris en main et les condés se tâtent pas les raquettes. Je suis libre des vapeurs d'eau écarlate et des tubes de colle à coups de latte. Les consonnes, les voyelles sont toutes à quatre pattes. Proc, c'est net, linguistique pure, style manteau en fourrure. Ma vie a pris une autre tournure. Je ne sais pas où cela me mène, mais même ceux qui m'aiment me décrivent comme étant un schizophrène. J'ai mis les mots au tapin pour la sensation. Trottoir, les syllabes, prostituer la diction, les lettres. Travaille pour moi, le dico est mon territoire, un pays dont je veux être le roi. J'ai traité de comme de vraies dames, tirer les plus belles pour les mettre en vitrine comme à Amsterdam. Si tu veux la qualité normale, tu payes cash, ça arrache à consommer avec un choc de hache. J'ai des potes dans la profession, c'est pas la mode, mais pourquoi crois-tu que tu en S s'appelle Monsieur Claude Petit? Parade avec tes illusions de Benz. J'ai une merde sur le marché parce que tes phrases sont Renz. C'est dommage, t'es guetté par le chômage. Mon organisation est trop en place, c'est bien trop sauvage. Ma famille vient de ce quartier qui faisait peur à Hitler ou la French Gene. Pour niquer la terre entière, je m'en souviens encore. Mais pourtant, je devais être petit. Scarface n'est pas un rêve, il a existé ici. L'italiano prend la relève 20 ans après. C'est tout notre monde, c'est tout notre marché. Je suis distrait, distant, dispo, prêt à disparaître. Mon discours éternel, seul un rêve peut renaître un jour. Sous une forme nouvelle de novice. Merci l'être, 100 000 mots à son service. N'est pas ma qui veut, mais je crois ses concurrents sérieux. Alors je redouble de travail et serre le jeu. Si tu veux la bombe, tu racres Ronald, ça se passe comme ça chez le Mac.